From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. As if this year's weather wasn't concerning enough with our historically low snowpack and dry conditions, experts are warning that next fall and winter could be even worse. Today on the show, you'll hear from the state's climatologist to learn about the El Niño effect. And while that weather pattern normally indicates a dry winter for the Pacific Northwest, early models suggest we could be heading toward a super El Niño, which could portend an extremely dangerous weather pattern for next year. Climate change is making our weather hotter and more intense, and that condition mixed with the super El Niño could be historic. Then, in the second part of the show, you'll hear from one of our own reporters about an historic ship that once ferried John Steinbeck and is making a comeback on the West Coast. That's next on Oregon on the Record. I'm sure many of us hope that next fall and winter will bring bountiful rain and snow to make up for this year's dismal precipitation. And while weather and climate are always unpredictable, especially this far out, early indications suggest we might have an even worse weather year this coming fall and winter. Our state's chief climatologist now explains. Larry O'Neill, associate professor at Oregon State University and the state climatologist for Oregon. Larry, always great talking to you. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you again for having me.
Boy, let's start with this. What is El Niño?
Yeah, El Niño, it sounds scary, but what it is it's basically a cycle of temperature in the Pacific Ocean along the equator. And an El Niño is a phase of this oscillation, which the warmer the water along the equator gets very warm, much warmer than normal. Hmm. And there's a reverse phase of this called La Niña, and that's when water along the equator gets much colder than normal.
Okay. What happens once that water warms? You know, talk about the impacts that we tend to see.
Yes. So up here in Oregon, we might be wondering, why do we care about the temperature along the equator? Well, what happens when that we get these really warm episodes during El Niños is it basically disrupts our global weather patterns. So it disrupts where rain falls. And so we get droughts in places. We get flooding in places, and then we also get changes in our hurricanes and tropical cyclones across the globe, and it really changes our weather patterns here in the Pacific Northwest. So for the Pacific Northwest, what usually happens during an El Niño is that we end up warmer and drier than normal, particularly during the falls and winters. And the other thing that happens is during El Niño years is the global temperature actually rises by quite a bit. And So we were already experiencing a really warm start to this year. And usually if this does end up becoming a very strong El Niño, we might see the all-time or the record global temperature broken.
Hmm. Well, that's kind of scary. So I know this past winter was very dry, but it wasn't El Niño. It wasn't El Niño in effect. It was just we just happened to have a dry and fairly warm winter.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and it was we were basically in neutral conditions or like a very weak La Niña, and so this basically we still have our kind of cycles of random weather patterns and things like that, but El Niños and La Niñas. Basically will have a tendency to push those weather patterns into a particular direction or not.
I see.
And so it's not it's kind of a rule of thumb that an El Niño is warm and dry here, but it's not the only thing that happens. We have other kind of these oscillations that are in our climate system, you know, how the ocean affects the weather and how the weather affects the ocean. And so there are times when other patterns, we start to see the impacts of other patterns rather than El Niño. But given that El Niños and La Niñas tend to give us the only source of predictability that we have more than a few weeks away.
Hmm. Okay. Do they always alternate? Is it always a La Niña and then the next year an El Niño? Or I guess maybe weather isn't that simple, is it?
No, it isn't. And that's what makes it fun to study. I really like studying it because of the complexities of this. What happens is that usually these patterns are, I wouldn't call them completely random, but they tend to oscillate with on timescales or you know, of 2 to 7 years or something like that. And typically we can get like an El Nino and then maybe a La Nina or neutral conditions for a couple of years and then maybe a La Nina or something like that. El Ninos tend to form in isolation with each other. So we have very rarely get 2 years in a row of El Nino. We can get more often consecutive years of La Nina. Hmm. And we did have that between 2022 and 2024, where we had 3 straight La Ninas in a row. But that is not very typical.
Okay. Many people might remember a few years ago when there was that heat dome that hit the Pacific Northwest. Was that something completely separate? Was that driven by an El Nino?
That was actually completely separate. So that one was due to, you know, kind of another set of factors that is a little bit more complicated. But that was not an impact from El Nino. That was kind of just a really random event.
Hmm. Interesting. Interesting. If you're just joining us, we're talking to the estate climatologist, Larry O'Neill. He's also an associate professor at OSU. Okay. I've also heard or I've read stories that it could be that this year is, I think it's called a super El Nino. Talk about what that might mean if this is a supercharged El Nino year for us.
Yes. So what is meant by a super El Nino is it's just about the magnitude of the temperatures along the Pacific. So a super El Nino just means the water there is going to be much, much warmer than a typical El Nino is. And in fact, many of the forecast models are now starting to really consistently put this event possibly as the strongest that we've ever observed, along El Nino that we've ever observed. And so this actually creates a little bit of uncertainty about what impacts we might see. For Oregon, historically, we've had 3 of these super El Ninos or very strong El Ninos, since we started monitoring this back in the 70s or 80s. Mm-hmm. And during two of those 3, we were actually much wetter than normal here in the Northwest in Oregon. And we had a good snowpack and things like that. And that goes against the rule of thumb for an El Nino that El Ninos are typically warm and dry events for us. And so it is possible that because this is going to be a very strong El Nino, that it's going to disrupt the weather patterns by so much that we actually get a rainier than normal winter. Hmm. However, that's not set in stone because we have not seen an event this strong before. So we are a little bit going to be learning on the fly with this one to see what is happening. And the stakes are really high this year because going into a very bad drought in much of the U.S. West and especially in Oregon. This year, our snowpack was historically low and the state was actually quite dry. And so at this point in time, we are really depending on a wet winter to restore our reservoirs and our soil moisture and our groundwater for next year so that we're not going into drought conditions. If that does not happen, the drought next year will be even worse than it is this year.
That is sobering. Is there anything, I've always heard about things like cloud seeding and those sorts of things. If it does turn out to be as bad as we might predict, I mean, is there anything that can be done to encourage more rain?
Yeah, the short answer is not really to the extent of what we'll need. Cloud seeding, there is a utility in Idaho that does some cloud seeding, and they've thought about doing it in central Oregon for a while, and I don't think it's being done right now. But essentially, cloud seeding might increase precipitation by something on the order of 5%.
Hmm.
Some people claim 10%. And, you know, so that could, like, you know, maybe partially mitigate some of the outcomes. But when we have, you know, winter in which we have only 70% of normal precipitation, only having 5 or 10% more still means we're in bad drought, maybe not as bad as we'd think. But otherwise, there's really nothing else that we can do to affect the weather.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like typically a typical El Nino has negative impacts for us and getting the type of rain and snow that we normally would expect. are there other areas of the globe that welcome an El Nino because it provides positive benefits?
There are parts of the Midwest here that end up getting more rain than normal. And so, you know, that's really beneficial for growing crops and things. Although mm-hmm. in some places you can get, it's kind of a fine line between sufficient rain and too much rain. There are other, so I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah.
So there are definitely parts where it can be beneficial, but it's usually a short-lived benefit and something you cannot rely on.
Okay. And I know, you know, weather is, like you said, it's fascinating to study because of the unpredictability. What accounts for that? You know, like you said, it could be a typical El Nino where we know basically what happens, and then all of a sudden it could be very, very different. What accounts for all that variability?
Yeah, there are a lot of things that it can account for it, but essentially weather systems tend to be fairly chaotic and random, and especially in the mid-latitudes of both the north and south, northern and southern hemispheres. So we live at about 45 degrees north latitude, so and that's usually where the jet stream is. So the jet stream can meander, and so that meandering of the jet stream can be responsible for high and low pressure, so for you know, nice weather and stormy weather. And that motion in the jet stream can be, there's a lot of things that affect it, but it is kind of a random dynamical system that is really hard to, or it's impossible to really know what's going to happen with it. With that said, there are some of these oscillations like El Niños and La Niñas. There are a couple other ones like the Pacific Decadal Oscillation and the North Atlantic Oscillation. That also give us a little some insight into, what we can expect from that and why the jet stream and the weather can be so random and chaotic. But that's kind of the very short answer.
Sure. And of course, it leads to another question, which I'm sure you have to deal with a lot: is climate change making phenomenon like El Nino even more severe?
To an extent, it is, and the extent is that the oceans are warming, and they're warming pretty rapidly, not as rapidly as the atmosphere is, but that warming signal is basically pushing things towards more El Nino-like states. But right now, we don't see a firm evidence yet of climate change really impacting the effects of El Niños or La Niñas on the rest of our weather systems. Climate models tend to be quite inconsistent with, you know, if El Niños or La Niñas are going to happen more often or not. But one thing we do know from the climate models is that precipitation extremes will happen more often separate from El Niños and La Niñas. So in this case, and then also the globe is just that our atmosphere is just warming. So El Niños now are warmer than they used to be, and La Niñas are warmer than they used to be. And so some of the impacts from that are starting to change in character, even though the phenomenon like El Niños and La Niñas themselves seem to be operating more or less as they did, you know, in our kind of undisturbed climate. And going back to the precipitation aspect of it is that we are observing that when we get heavy rains, downpours and things like that, they tend to be heavier and more isolated. So that means there's more flood risk and things like that. And then when we get dry periods, those dry periods are drier than they used to be.
He's Larry O'Neill. He is Oregon's state climatologist, also an associate professor at OSU. Larry, it's always great to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming on.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Now let's check in with KLCC's Brianna Bowman about a ship called the Western Flyer. Brianna Bowman, our weekend edition host, thanks so much for coming in and talking to me.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I know you've been busy all weekend, and now I've captured you for today to talk about a very interesting story you just put together. Talk about the Western Flyer.
I'm so excited to share this story with our KLCC listeners. The Western Flyer is maybe one of the most famous fishing boats in the world. Hmm. It was built in, I believe, 1937, fished in the sardine fisheries in Central California.
Okay.
And then in 1940, John Steinbeck and his best friend, Ed Ricketts, who is a marine ecologist, chartered the boat for a research expedition in the Sea of Cortez, also known as the Gulf of California. Mm-hmm. So they spent about 6 weeks down there collecting marine organisms, mostly invertebrates, documenting what they saw. And then after the trip concluded, Steinbeck wrote about the trip and actually co-authored a narrative about the trip with Ricketts, though Steinbeck is mostly credited with it. And now you can read about their journey in Steinbeck's novel, The Log from the Sea of Cortez. And yeah, it's just an incredible story. And so the Western Flyer was kind of lost to time for a few decades after that. It had a few different jobs. It was a crabber in the Bering Sea. It was chartered by the International Pacific Halibut Commission for some research into trawl bycatch in the 60s. Then the Western Flyer truly faded into obscurity and was actually renamed as the Gemini. And as any seafarer knows, boats that are renamed is regarded as bad luck.
Oh, really?
Huh. Yeah. And it actually, when it was named the Gemini, it sunk twice at the dock in Anacortes.
Wow.
And actually spent up to 6 months underwater. Then a man named John Gregg, who read the log of the Sea of Cortez as a boy, he recognized the boat, knew what the boat's history was, what its significance was to literature and marine science, and he bought the boat, restored it, set up the Western Flyer Foundation, and now the boat is restored to its former glory, and it's a gorgeous vessel.
Wow. It's so interesting because obviously most of us know Steinbeck from his novels, Travels with Charlie, mm-hmm. Grapes of Wrath, all that great stuff. Kind of an amateur scientist in this regard.
Yeah, I think from reading his biography, either in the copy of the book that I have or online, I believe he may have done part of a marine biology degree at some point. So it was something that really interested him.
Wow.
And then, of course, he and Ed Ricketts were really good friends, even best friends. And it was just something that really interested him. So, yeah.
Okay. And so it's now rechristened as the Western Flyer.
Yes.
What's it doing now? Where can people maybe see it?
Well, so my story is about how it just concluded its visit to the Pacific Northwest.
Okay.
It did make a visit to Newport last month, and it was also visiting Charleston, Coos Bay. It made some stops in Washington. It just spent a couple of weeks in Seattle. It's now making its way down the West Coast back to Moss Landing.
Okay.
It's endeavoring, the foundation wants to have the boat visit the Pacific Northwest every other year. And then on the off years, the alternating years, it will recreate the visit or recreate the trip that Ricketts and Steinbeck did to the Sea of Cortez. So they'll take it down to the Gulf of California and recreate their expedition.
Wow. And will actual science be conducted on the boat?
Yes, that's one of the really cool things about the Western Flyer. So it is currently being used as a education and outreach tool, but then also real scientists are collecting oceanographic data from the Western Flyer. Jack Barth, he's a OSU professor. He's an oceanographer, and he collects data, oceanographic data from the Western Flyer. So it's also contributing to science as well.
What does it say that something that, like you said, was at the bottom of the ocean was able to be restored? What does it say about sort of our love of history?
Yeah, I think it's just our love of stories. Mm-hmm. This boat just has such an incredible story associated with it. And I am currently reading The Log from the Sea of Cortez right now. And it was, you just get this sort of amazing feeling, this you're stepping into history when you step on the boat. So I got to walk around the Western Flyer when it was in Newport, and seeing the boat after reading how Steinbeck described it and seeing it in front of you, it just, it's an amazing feeling.
What was it like walking on wood and planks that one of the most famous American authors once trod? What was that like?
I know. I'm like getting chills just thinking about it. The boat itself is gorgeous. So it's a wooden boat. It was restored by the Port Townsend Shipwrights Cooperative, and the detail that they went, the extent of the detail that they went to maintain the character and the accuracy of the boat. So 90% of the wheelhouse, everything above deck is as it was back in 1940 when they went on the expedition. They had to replace quite a bit below deck, but the character of the boat is maintained down to the details of the head or the bathroom on the boat, the original tiling and the original wood and the color of the paint. All these little things just recreate exactly what it would have been like when it went down to the Sea of Cortez.
Wow. About how long did it take to restore the boat?
Oh, I know it took years.
Wow.
Years for for the Shipwrights Cooperative to restore it. And the Western Flyer Foundation has some really great articles and photos of that restoration process on their website. I really encourage listeners to check it out.
Yeah, yeah. I imagine when you went to tour the boat, maybe you talked to other folks, what did they say about this sort of stepping on to literal history?
Yeah, so I think one of my favorite conversations I had was with the current captain, Paul Tate, who I found out is my neighbor in Newport. Had no idea.
Small town.
Right? Yes, very small town. And he had known about the boat his entire career. Paul has this long and storied career in fishing in Alaska, also working for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, working for the Coast Guard, working for different research vessels. And he says that now he's the captain of this famous boat. He just pinches himself. Mm. He can't believe that this is what he's doing at this stage of his life.
Brianna Bowman, our reporter here, does a weekend edition for us. Brianna, thank you so much for coming in and talking about the Western Flyer.
Of course. Thank you, Michael.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Many of us use the term forage when we scan the contents of our fridge or pantry, but tomorrow's guest is literally foraging in the wild, city parks, and even roadsides for 100% of his food. I'm Michael Dunn, host of Oregon on the Record. Thanks for listening.